Invisible Illness. For the purpose of this podcast, this term will encompass hidden mental and physical conditions.
We're Freya and Liv, students at the University of Nottingham, and in each episode, we will be exploring the impact these invisible conditions can have.
That's why we spoke to Rosie about her experience living with borderline personality disorder.
Just a heads up, some people might find some of the things we discuss here uncomfortable.
If you need it, there will be useful contact details in the description below.
A quick Google search of the term invisible illness comes up with a number of definitions. In your opinion, what does invisible illness mean?
To me, it means an illness that other people can't see. When people look at me, they don't see someone who's ill. They expect me to be able to do things that normal functioning people are able to do. And for that reason, my illness comes with a lot of stigma. A lot of people haven't heard about this illness, and there's also a lot of misconceptions. When I say to someone, I have borderline personality disorder, their immediate thought is, I've got split personality. There's a lack of understanding, and I think just the term personality disorder can be quite misleading. It sounds like there's something wrong with my personality rather than it being largely an emotion-based illness. For me, borderline personality disorder is an illness in which I am unbearably sensitive to the world around me and to my own emotions. It's an illness of excruciatingly painful extremes. I'm either on top of the world or I'm suicidal. I'm the best or I'm the worst. I'm feeling everything at once or nothing at all. It feels like a cohort of the most unpleasant symptoms of a range of other mental illnesses. It's an illness that for me has stemmed out of buried childhood and adolescent trauma that's climbed back up and underpins everything I do. And in spite of the constant agony, the constant conflict, the constant guilt, is an illness that is stigmatised, ignored, met with distaste, even by the professionals that are meant to help me. I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, BPD, also known as emotionally unstable personality disorder, when I was 18. The diagnosis initially came as a relief. I'd spent the past year under section in a psychiatric unit, and years before that under community mental health services. And although I'd been diagnosed with depression and anxiety from my first CAMHS assessment stage 13, it seemed to confirm what I knew to be true. I had a complex and enduring mental health problem that was resistant to medication and required therapeutic intervention. Whilst my mood had been lifted and my anxiety had been lowered by the heavy doses of medication I had been prescribed, it felt reassuring to know that there was a reason why I was still sick. Initially, the diagnosis gave me hope that I could get better.
I think obviously Rosie's definition of BPD is kind of...
it's a lot more personal to her.
Yeah, I was going to say less clinical, I think, is the thing that particularly struck me, because when I was researching BPD, the NHS website lists a lot of symptoms, so emotional instability, disturbed patterns of thinking or perception, impulsive behaviour, intense but unstable relationship with others. And this is things that Rosie talks about, but I think it's very much more evident when she discusses it, how much pain it causes her.
Yeah, and I think that's something that the definition on the NHS kind of, it lacks.
Yeah, they do obviously go further into it. They discuss the symptoms and they say there's four areas of emotional instability. The psychological term for this is affective dysregulation. So disturbed patterns of thinking or perception, impulsive behaviour, etc., etc. And then with this whole emotional instability element of it, there's really intense negative emotions, which, you know, you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. We're talking rage, sadness, shame, panic, terror. So you're experiencing symptoms, as she said, of a wide range of mental health issues. You're experiencing symptoms of depression and anxiety, a lot of other things, and it sounds like it's all kind of wrapped up in this one really horrible disease.
I agree. I think that the definition on the NHS website, it is more clinical, and even just by them using the clinical terms for things, like the more scientific vocabulary, that's something that I think in Rosie's definition, she, I think, better portrays her kind of the impact that it's had on her life a little bit more.
It's also, as they say, it's common for people with BPD to experience suicidal feelings and disturbed or uncontrollable thoughts, and that's definitely something that Rosie talks about, but it just seems... I don't know if you can glean an entire understanding of it from reading the NHS webpage, which is obviously something Rosie talks about right at the end. She says, I'm not defined by what someone writes about me on a webpage or what a psychologist says. I'm still a person, and this still affects me as a person. I think that's maybe something that what we've researched online kind of misses, is this idea that it's not a disorder that exists separately to the person who suffers from it.
Rosie mentions about CAMHS, which, for anybody listening who doesn't know what that stands for, it stands for Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. CAMHS are the NHS services that assesses and treat young people with emotional, behavioural or mental health difficulties. And something we've just heard Rosie talk about is how she was diagnosed with BPD after she'd kind of graduated from CAMHS and then moved into like the mental health services that are provided for adults through the NHS.
This is definitely an issue with CAMHS that I've found is extensively discussed by people who have quite serious mental health issues, is that they're not necessarily always designed for the most or more complex mental health issues, or they neglect to offer diagnoses that extend beyond perhaps more simple mental health issues, i.e. depression, anxiety, which have this debilitating impact, there's no doubt about it, but in terms of actual complex things like personality disorders, issues like that, they're more reluctant, I think, to really explore that when you're underage.
And I think that I find that quite interesting, actually, because you'd think that the main goal of any medical professional would be to provide a diagnosis, and the fact that they almost seem reluctant to do this, I find quite almost surprising, because it's very different to other areas of the health system, I guess.
I know that from more personal experience, in terms of getting things like referrals and stuff when you're underage, it is incredibly difficult. I remember I've sat in a doctor's office and she's been like, well, I wish I could offer you something more, but unfortunately you're underage. And so it's self-referral or it's CAMHS, but in terms of comprehensive mental health advice and aid, there's not a lot we can do when you're underage. And obviously, teenagers have to graduate from CAMHS eventually into adult mental health services when they reach a certain age. And you do get told about that a few months in advance, I think. But I can understand and empathise with this frustration at this idea that you kind of don't get the full support until you've already experienced an incredible amount of time where you're just kind of getting a more basic level of support just because you're a child.
I hadn't myself heard of CAMHS really before talking to Rosie. And when I was doing some research into it, on the website it was saying that the transition to adult services is a big change. And it's important that you get as much information and support as you can get from family. And I think that CAMHS themselves are supposed to kind of help and assist with that transition through a series of like assessments and a care plan. But like, obviously I don't have any personal experience with that. I'm not sure of the effectiveness of this, and I assume any transition is going to be difficult from one health system to another.
Unfortunately, the issue is that, especially if you're kind of on the NHS or you're receiving more public sector healthcare, they're just incredibly stretched. And as much as I think, you know, good intentions with CAMHS and stuff like that, an issue is that simply they can't provide the support that is really required. And that's something that in adult services is still prevalent, and Rosie talks about it later with DBT and stuff as well.
My diagnosis of BPD occurred after I was transferred from a children's to an adult's unit. Although at the time I couldn't understand why, the consultant on my children's ward refused to consider BPD as a possible overarching diagnosis, and he wasn't the only one. Months before I'd turned 18, I'd had an unsuccessful section tribunal where the NHS England bed manager told my parents that they would be silly to pursue a BPD diagnosis and I would end up with less help. Instead, the ward psychologist was in the process of assessing me for autism, a condition that is often diagnosed in the place of BPD due to the similarity of some symptoms. Once diagnosed with BPD, despite having spent the previous year on high observations in a secure unit, I was discharged within weeks from hospital. Although I was glad to be discharged off my section and luckily felt able to keep myself safe and stay motivated in order to start university the following September, it seems strange that this diagnosis was the sole justification for the discharge of a patient whom the consultant had only met a few times. The same thing happened when I was resectioned to hospital briefly during my first year of university. I only met the consultant twice and was only days free from a serious incident when he decided to override my section paperwork and discharge me. In this sense, it feels not only is my illness invisible to the general public, but as a person, I also become invisible behind the label of BPD, and my safety becomes secondary to the textbook stereotypes even professionals perpetuate. Other sufferers of borderline personality disorder haven't been as lucky with the arguably reckless approach approach that professionals have towards treatment. Positive risk-taking, a popular approach to personality disorder patients, is risky business and too often leads to serious incidents or death. Since my diagnosis, I've been told that people with your illness shouldn't be in hospital, you don't really want to die, there's nothing we can do for you. Putting PD patients on one-to-one reinforces the need for attention, things that us borderlines hear from professionals all the time. Sadly, I lost a close friend last year to this negligent practice. Hours before her death, she had a serious incident, yet the unit refused to increase her observations because of her status as a PD patient. It's not an uncommon occurrence.
In this section, Rosie discusses something called a section tribunal, which when I did some research on it, I believe it's to do with an independent panel that can discharge you from the Mental Health Act. So a tribunal hearing takes place at a hospital, and the tribunal has to decide whether or not you meet the criteria for being sectioned. So the tribunal has the power to discharge you from your section, recommend that you get leave, recommend supervised community treatment instead of staying in hospital, decide on a delayed discharge or conditional discharge, transfer you to another hospital, or meet up with you again if their recommendations are not followed. However, the hospital is not legally obliged to follow their recommendations.
So that's kind of, I guess, a way of making sure that people who need to be sectioned are, and people who need other kind of support are offered that as well, I assume?
Yeah, unfortunately in this case, Rosie does say that her section tribunal was unsuccessful, and the NHS England bed manager told her parents that they would be silly to pursue a BPD diagnosis, which I think, you know, is linked very heavily to this idea of stigma that Rosie discusses quite extensively, and the difficulty of receiving treatment when you do suffer from BPD.
I found it really interesting that Rosie talks about the fact that she was nearly kind of looked at or assessed for autism. I'd not realised before speaking to her that the symptoms for autism and BPD can actually be quite similar.
I think there are some similarities. I wouldn't want to sort of start being like, this is what's similar with this, because I'm not entirely sure, but I can understand that there's a level of sort of
overlap, perhaps.
Yeah, and this idea that this is also called EUPD, which is emotionally unstable personality disorder. There are links, I believe, with autism. And it's, you know, it's quite upsetting in many respects that someone can be misdiagnosed in that respect. You know, you can be diagnosed as autistic rather than suffering with borderline personality disorder, which then just sets back treatment such a long way because they are so different.
I found it incredibly surprising though, or not necessarily surprising, but it was a little bit of a shock when Rosie was telling us about how her treatment, once she'd been diagnosed with BPD, changed significantly, because like all of a sudden things that she'd kind of had access to beforehand, she wasn't seem eligible for. Which I found really, really surprising.
She talks about how she felt lucky that she was managed to be discharged and start university the following September. But she also kind of expresses this frustration about the idea that just because she had a diagnosis, suddenly they were happy to sort of discharge her from being a patient under her section. But she doesn't feel like she actually got the support. She only met the consultant a few times, I think, and she still had to be resectioned during her first year of university, and luckily she managed to remain at university. But, you know, perhaps with a level of support that was more appropriate to her needs, it would have been a lot easier for her not to have to take that time out of university. And I know that something that people really struggle with is the fact that there aren't enough beds in hospitals for people to be located close to where they live or close to where they go to university. So very often individuals have to go hundreds of miles away. And I know in the last year, there have been times when every single bed in the hospitals in England are full, and there's just nowhere for people to go when they suffer, you know, from moments of really bad suicidal ideation, from suicide attempts, from breakdowns. There were days when there was just no beds.
I find it really interesting as well that when Rosie was talking about how after she'd received the BPD diagnosis, that people would then start to say to her, you shouldn't be sectioned. And I think
you don't really want to die, blah, 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 your suicidal thoughts aren't real.
She does talk about that a lot. And I was just looking on the NHS website, and actually under the heading of treating BPD, the kind of treatment that they have listed there is a range of individual and group psychological therapies and things, I assume, are like DBT.
Which obviously she discusses it further later on. What I just wanted to quickly draw attention to was, as you were saying about this idea of people saying you don't really want to die, you don't need to be in hospital for your illness, etc., was she discussed the fact that a lot of people with borderline personality disorder are treated with something called positive risk taking. And I was kind of exploring this, I was doing some research into it, and it seems to be this idea of allowing an individual to make their own decisions with regards to treatment, and it means that they have to take an independent approach, I suppose, to recovery, in terms of the fact that they won't get as much help as they possibly feel like they require. And Rosie was talking about being on observations, and the fact that she discusses her friend, who I don't want to go too much into that because I don't feel like it's appropriate to explore that, but this is the problem with treatment, is that positive risk taking, it makes sense theoretically, but if a person is on a level where they don't feel like they can guarantee their own safety,
like, I guess, have care for themselves.
I guess that's maybe the difference that we were discussing earlier between a clinical understanding of BPD and the actual experience of suffering with BPD, and maybe two very different things.
I would completely agree with that.
Life with BPD in the community can be even more frustrating than life within the clinical walls of a unit. Although the justification for being discharged from hospital was that I would benefit more from therapeutic help in the community, this therapeutic help demands long and excruciating assessments before you're even admitted onto the waiting list. The recommended treatment for BPD is dialectical behavioural therapy, DBT. However, in my area, there are only limited spaces in a group setting that teaches watered-down DBT skills. Once you have suffered the long waiting list and finally completed this group, which could take years, only then are you referred to the comprehensive one-to-one DBT therapy approved by NICE guidelines. And of course, if you miss more than two appointments or are admitted as an inpatient during this time, you are taken off the waiting list back to square one.
Just for people who might be listening who aren't aware, NICE guidelines stands for the guidelines that are kind of agreed upon by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence.
Rosie speaks here about dialectical behavioural therapy, otherwise known as DBT. Just to let anyone who doesn't know be aware, the goal of DBT is to help people to manage their difficult emotions by letting themselves experience, recognise and accept them. Then, as they learn to accept and regulate their emotions, they also become more able to change their harmful behaviour. To help people achieve this, DBT therapists use a balance of acceptance and change techniques.
Before we kind of spoke to Rosie, this was like, I'd never really heard the term DBT before. So like, we decided we'd do a little bit of research, and I think like it kind of helped me understand a little bit more what it was about, because I hadn't really before known.
I think a lot of people are probably familiar with the concept of CBT, which is cognitive behavioural therapy, and for what's known as like non-complex mental health issues, which, you know, is a interesting term to use, but it's a term that is used. CBT is kind of like the go-to. DBT, I think, becomes more specialised.
And I think I remember reading that DBT tends to kind of focus more on events that may have happened in the past, whereas isn't CBT more about learning how to
much grounded in like the everyday ways of changing your way of operating and finding behaviours that are damaging to your mental health and kind of changing them. And I think it probably is useful for a lot of people, but then equally it's not as helpful for other people, especially with people where a lot of issues go back to sort of deep-rooted trauma in the past.
Rosie also talks about life with BPD in the community, which we've kind of touched on briefly, but I think we've not really given it a lot of time yet, is this idea of stigma when people talk about personality disorders. And like, personally, I think even the use of the words personality disorders tends to almost give a slight negative connotation for many people. And I think part of that is because a lot of people perhaps don't fully understand or know what a personality disorder is or what it consists of and how it affects people. But also just kind of the words themselves.
Yeah, I think it kind of suggests something inherently wrong or abnormal.
Which obviously isn't true at all in any way.
This is something that a lot of anecdotal stuff that I've read about BPD suggests, is that people who suffer with this, a lot of the time they sort of say, I don't want people to think there's something inherently wrong with me. I'm not necessarily manipulative, don't necessarily carry these characteristics that are meant to be apparent in people who suffer with BPD. I think there is potentially a problem with the phrase personality disorder. It's just what to use to replace that, especially because BPD is also known as EUPD, which is emotionally unstable personality disorder, which I don't think is the kindest term.
I think that the people who have BPD, they are the most qualified people to decide, really, in my opinion, what term we should use to refer to BPD.
This is something that is frustrating as well, with carrying this diagnosis. You don't have a great deal of power over what your diagnosis is, which I think in some respects is very frustrating. And with this idea of stigma as well, I think something that I know I find particularly frustrating is that people are very happy to be like, oh yeah, you have a mental illness, it must be really hard for you, until the point where people start to display characteristics of a mental health disorder, especially with something as complicated as BPD, but also with things like depression and anxiety. People are very willing to be sympathetic up until the point that they actually have to regulate or moderate or change something in their lives to help accommodate someone else's mental health issues. And I think that's the crux of what a lot of stigma is. It's not, oh, I've seen this mentally ill person and I think that they're crazy. I think we've gone beyond that as a society, but the stigma is still very much there.
Have you felt let down by institutions that were meant to help?
Yes, I feel like, although Children's Mental Health Services were trying to protect me somewhat by trying to avoid a BPD diagnosis, if I'd been diagnosed with it earlier, I'd have probably been able to access DBT before. Also, since being diagnosed with this, I've been turned down by a lot of services. The University Counselling Service won't see me. There's various counselling services in the area that won't see me because it's seen as a complex illness.
Do you think the mental health network is more helpful or hindering to recovery?
I think it works both ways, but it really depends on your approach. You can stay positive and try and stay on the more positive side of it, but it can be really easy to get dragged into the more toxic side, where it is a competition of how many times you've been in hospital, how bad your self-harm is, and from that sense, it's not very helpful at all. I'm lucky to have some regular help for my invisible illness. I see my community psychiatric nurse fortnightly and a psychiatrist every 6 weeks. I'm also incredibly lucky to have a family that are incredibly understanding. But having lost the majority of my school friends during the worst time of my life following trauma and then my admission to hospital for the first time, I've come to university and found friends who do understand me, who see beyond the illness. My best friend at university also has BPD. We're nothing like each other in temperament, and at first it was shocking to discover that she also had this illness because her past is so different to mine, but it makes sense now. Sufferers of this horrible illness don't conform to stereotypes. We haven't all been sectioned or spent time as an inpatient. We don't all self-harm. We haven't all experienced trauma. We aren't manipulative or attention-seeking. We aren't all young women, and you can't tell from looking at someone whether or not they have BPD. The thing that BPD sufferers share in common is their strength to fight not only a debilitating, consuming illness, but to deal with the stigma and then be done with it. I'm not defined by what someone on Google or even an old, backward psychiatrist says. I unfortunately suffer from BPD, but recovery is possible, and I believe that I'm well on my way to recovery.
When researching BPD, we found terms labelling it colloquially the leprosy of mental illness.
The problem with this, though, is that arguably this term further stigmatises BPD, because
it has connotations, I think, of, if you look at, I guess, the social stigma around leprosy and stuff like that, it has these connotations of being something that people want to stay away from and people don't want to get too close to. And I understand where you're coming from in terms of you're saying, like, it's equating BPD to this state of being a social outcast, of being unable to form relationships with people because of an illness, which I do agree stigmatises it. However, may also be relevant to note that that's kind of how it feels.
I think that's why it's really crucial that we kind of work out how to refer to this condition in a way that won't increase the stigma surrounding it, but is a term that people are happy with, especially those who suffer from BPD.
We probably need to be more careful about the way that we talk about mental illness. And I think there's
at the same time, though, yes, we all need to be careful, but also I don't want that to stop the discussion. The discussion needs to be had, and I feel like people can't be scared, but at the same time we do have to think how we're going to talk about these things. Inner strength is something that Rosie focuses on when we were speaking to her throughout, and it's something that I'd like to pick up on, because I think sometimes it's not always something that's recognised, that people who suffer from mental illness, they kind of have so much inner strength to be able to kind of...
It's this idea of recovery, isn't it, I think, and day-to-day life and all of this kind of thing is wrapped up in this idea of recovery that a lot of people talk about, and needing inner strength to recover, I think, is something that... It's a given. I think it's not hard for people to understand this idea of you need strength to recover.
I think, though, with inner strength, it's not something that you can physically see. So sometimes it kind of is... I hesitate to say glossed over, but I feel like sometimes it's missed and people don't always recognise it.
You know, it sounds a bit cliche to be like, oh, she had that inner strength to recover, because the thing is that recovery is by no means at all linear. You don't decide to recover one day and then go on this quest to find yourself, and then one day you get to this point where you're like, I'm okay. Recovery is more like a series of dips, and it's a metaphor that I don't like using, but it is like a roller coaster, because there's no way of knowing what you're going to be like when you wake up one day. And I don't think recovery is always a choice either. I don't think it's as simple as that, and it's not about this sudden strength to decide that you're going to get better. Sometimes you just find yourself kind of taken along by it.
And just going back to what I was saying before, I don't think that this inner strength is about overcoming something. Sometimes it's just about having the strength to perhaps get up each day and fight even the same battle. It's the strength of navigating yourself through that process, which might never, like, it doesn't necessarily have a start and an end point.
Recovery, it's a term that's thrown around a lot, and it's, you know, you hear it all the time, this person's in recovery, I'm in recovery, but recovery isn't a thing. It's not a palpable stage in your life, and this is something that I spent a long time trying to understand, is that recovery isn't just a process that you suddenly embark on. It's so different for everyone. It doesn't really exist. It's not, as much as mental health communities online like to create this idea that we're all in recovery and all of this, it's not a thing that exists in a homogenous way that allows people to come together. My recovery is going to be completely different to someone else's recovery, and their recovery is going to be completely different to another person's recovery. And some people may never get to the point where they feel like they've recovered.
I think you're completely right. Recovery is very different for everyone, and it is a bit of a misnomer. Do you think, though, Freya, that everybody always wants to recover?
No, I think that's another kind of narrative that people like to use, is that you choose to recover, but it's crucial that you don't always want to recover. It's something that people need to understand, maybe, is that recovery is hard. Rosie talks about the fact that she made friends on her inpatient ward. She made friends through the recovery network online. She made her best friend suffers from BPD as well, and that's not a bad thing at all. And it's this thing of the fact that you do identify with your mental illness, of course you do, it comes to be such a massive part of your life, it comes to define your life in some respect, but it also means that people don't always want to get better.
It's not always about becoming better, but learning to better deal with your mental illness, because perhaps, talking about identity, your mental illness is perhaps never going to fully go away. It could always be something that you're battling with.
There's a question, I think, especially with regards to complex mental illnesses such as BPD, as to whether anyone ever can recover from something like that, or whether it's a management thing. The NHS website says that it's possible to recover from depression, and it's possible to recover from anxiety with a series of different treatments that they recommend. But I think regardless of that, it might not be that you ever get to the point where the symptoms of your mental illness disappear, and I think that's something that's maybe not right to aspire to. I think recovery, as I said, looks different to different people.
The other thing with recovery is that I think a lot of people think that to be recovered, you have to have attained everybody else's perception of what is normal. And yeah, again, just like mental illnesses are different for everyone, and just like recovery is different for everyone, everyone's normal is also very different.
I think it's also a thing of when you've been ill for such a long time, when your life has become defined by a series of pretty torturous constants, and when it gets to a certain point, a series of pretty numb and simultaneously painful experiences of existence, the idea that that's not going to be your existence anymore, that's not going to be your normal, is kind of terrifying. And it is kind of a little bit like someone saying, oh well, as of tomorrow you're only going to have one arm. It's a bit like, well, I don't know how to not be ill, I don't know how to not have a mental illness, I don't know what I even look like without a mental illness. That's the thing, mental illness is your normal. It's not something that's like attached to you or separate to you. It is so much ingrained in your life, it's so much ingrained in your identity, that I don't know how people can speak about recovery as though it's a process that you go through and one day you'll come out of the other side. I'm not even sure if it's possible to rid yourself of the symptoms of a mental illness entirely, or maybe you can rid yourself of the symptoms.
That's something Rosie talks about quickly, is she emphasises that symptoms as well are different for everyone. So on the NHS website there's a list of symptoms of people who are suffering from this mental illness or this mental illness, but that doesn't mean that if you're suffering from a specific mental illness, you're going to have the same symptoms as everybody else.
Exactly, and obviously that is something Rosie talks about. As you said, she talks about her best friend who suffers from BPD in an entirely different way to the way she does. I think it's also interesting to note that it's at times frustrating or naive to suggest that treatment based on this idea of what the symptoms are rather than the person can be frustrating, it can be difficult, because Rosie says, I'm not similar in temperament to my best friend at all, but she also has BPD. I'm not similar to a lot of people who have BPD. Arguably they're achieving a similar type of treatment because the healthcare system goes, well, these are the symptoms of BPD, this is the treatment we offer for BPD, and this is what we're going to do. And it's similar with depression and anxiety, but people experience those mental illnesses in completely different ways.
We were talking earlier about how mental health can form part of someone's identity, and I just wondered, Freya, what your thoughts were about people using mental illness or their mental health as a kind of armor, and actually, can we really, is that something that's dangerous or not? And actually, can we blame people for doing that when from a young age we're often taught to kind of take what people say about us and then kind of use that as a form of armor in itself?
It's individualistic, but equally people, there's a way of sort of identifying with other people through suffering with mental health and meeting people who identify with you and then creating this kind of community with them. And I think in a way that is an armor, that's a way of self and mutual protection of other people as well. And this idea that you find someone who understands you and you share similar symptoms, and it's very easy, I think, in that respect for mental health communities to sprout up and exist. And that, in that way, I don't think it's necessarily a negative thing. That is a form of armor, but it's maybe positive unless it becomes toxic, which it is also prone to doing. I think I don't know if I can say, and I don't think it's necessarily my place to say, whether or not someone should identify with their illness. And I would not want to sit here and tell people how they should identify with their illness, because I don't think that's right. The danger of identifying with your illness too much and it becoming your identity is that it becomes harder to let the negative symptoms go, and it becomes harder to separate yourself from your illness. Because as much as I talk about illness becoming part of your identity and being part of you, it is also something that is happening to you that exists because of, a lot of the time, because of chemical imbalances in your brain, because of childhood trauma, because of anything like that. It's not inherent, maybe, is what I'm trying to get at. It's the danger of using it as your armor is that it becomes you more than you are you, maybe.
Before talking to Rosie, I kind of hate to admit it, but I didn't really fully understand what BPD was. And I think that's still probably I don't want to say a problem, but I think that there's still a lack of clarity about different mental illnesses and how they differ from each other. We're talking about mental illness more now, I think, but I don't think people still fully understand the differences between mental illnesses. Like, I feel like a lot of people don't know what BPD is fully.
Definitely. I think people have a grasp of kind of what depression and anxiety are. I still don't think if you don't have anxiety and you don't have depression, it's difficult to understand, but it's easier to grasp.
And I think it's the same with BPD. Like, for someone who's never experienced BPD or depression or anxiety, like, it is going to be more difficult to understand what that person is going through.
I think with personality disorders, it becomes a lot more complex, and I can understand why people don't know what they are. You ask me what BPD is and how it feels, I could not tell you because I don't suffer from it. I don't think anyone who hasn't suffered from this kind of complex mental illness can say what it's like, but I think we need some more awareness and understanding and to kind of rid ourselves of stigma. And like, leading on from that, something that I want to talk about briefly that is difficult to talk about but unfortunately comes along with mental illness is this idea of suicide and suicidal ideation. And there's a massive stigma around suicide. There's a massive stigma around the idea that it's selfish, or that you shouldn't do it, or that you should have reached out for help, or you should have done something more. And I don't want to preach about it, and I don't want to tell people how they should react to it or anything like that. I don't think it's appropriate, but I just thought we could discuss some of the statistics that you found.
Yep, so whilst doing some research for this, we came across some quite interesting statistics, and that one of those was that I think is quite interesting is that around 3/4 of all suicides in 2016 in the UK were male. And I think that, I don't mean interesting per se, I think it's just that it's almost surprising, I think, for some people.
Yeah, I think mental illness is not always associated with men as that easily, almost. I feel like,
and that's something that Rosie actually touches on. She says, like, one of the misconceptions about BPD is that most people tend to believe that, or a lot of people tend to believe that it's mainly women that suffer with BPD.
Young women, yeah.
That's not true at all, and she points that out.
Yeah,
and I think that's
does.
Really important to kind of emphasise.
It's also something that I found in my research was that men are much more likely to go for very violent methods of suicide. Again, I'm not going to discuss them, I don't think it's appropriate, but women are more likely to go for less violent methods of suicide. And I think whatever you want to take from that, I don't want to go in too far into the analysis of that, but I think that suicide and mental illness, suicide just needs more attention. I don't think there's any other way to put it apart from that, suicidal ideation. And there is this issue that when you go for treatment, if you don't say I am suicidal, if you don't seem like you're a danger to yourself, you just don't get the same level of help. It's almost as if they don't have the facilities to help you until you're at the point where
it's almost too late.
Yeah, it's life or death. And unfortunately, that is linked a lot to underfunding of mental health services, underfunding of the NHS. It's not necessarily the fault of anyone who works in mental health. People who work in mental health are amazing, and it's a very difficult and at times painful job, but unfortunately, unless you're at crisis point, it's sometimes very difficult to get treatment.
We've titled this podcast, But You Don't Look Sick. What does this phrase mean to you?
I feel like professionals sometimes, even with mental health, don't know how to treat something. If you can't see it physically, sometimes their solution is just to prescribe a lot of medication. And I think this happened to me. Obviously, antidepressants helped me with my mood, but when my behaviour was still very problematic, but I didn't have a BPD diagnosis, I was on very heavy doses of mood stabilisers and antipsychotics, medication that isn't normally prescribed for BPD, and the effects were counterproductive, really.
Each week, we ask the people that feature on this podcast to give a word that they feel best sums up their experience.
Rosie's going to go next.
Courage.
Resilience.
Tune in to our next episode as we continue our exploration into invisible illness. You can find us on URN's Facebook page, Audio Boom, and Mixcloud.
This is URN.